Okay. So we're going to call the meeting to order. We need to get started. Is those of you that are in the room from the last hearing, if you could clear the room, I'm going to call the meeting to order. Members, we're going to have a change. My bill is not going to be first. We're going to have Representative Mariani's bill first, House File 768. We have a testifier that needs to get going. This is the problem with having this committee late in the day. As we know, it conflicts with all kinds of other family and other activities. Representative Mariani, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. Madam Chair, yes, I would move House File 768, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Education Finance Bill.
Thank you. Representative Mariani moves House File 768, laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. If you'd like to proceed with your...
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we exchanged a good grin because in my own committee I have a hard time figuring out what the motions are for any bill before me. It's just
you do a great job.
Well, thank you. I have good staff that helps with that. Madam Chair, members, this bill does two important things in the child care assistance program. As many of you heard from previous testimony, child care assistance programs have absorbed, really, in my opinion, very huge cuts in state funding going back to at least 2003 when we froze the provider rates to the 2001 rate level. And since then, we've adjusted that reduced rate twice, but frankly, we have not returned it anywhere near to the levels of the 75% of market rates that were in existence prior to that freeze. Members, most of the committee's work in this committee involves making the investments in our young that we trust will produce long-term positive results. It's one of the true privileges of serving in this committee to be sort of the steward of a society that is many years out for us in terms of the investments that we make in the young. Citizens and residents of the state that will see strong payoffs, you know, a good 15, 20, 30 years down the line. And ensuring access to child care services, if we're talking about quality care, produces those long-term good returns. But this is one area also where we work on where the payoff is immediate. In these kinds of massive financial stress, where finding and keeping jobs is hard to do, CCAP funding is an immediate payoff kind of thing to do. By funding the waiting list, we remove a barrier to work that we badly need now, and we badly need now more than ever to make it possible for parents to go to work. So the bill sets the maximum, does two things. It sets the maximum rates of child care assistance rates at the 75% rate of the market. So it takes us back to where we were going into that 2003 session, and it appropriates funds to eliminate the waiting list in the basic sliding fee program, which then removes those barriers for parents to be able to work. So, Madam Chair, that's really basically it. I'm just going to ask my testifiers to offer their testimony, and then we'll be open to questions and discussions.
Thank you. Well, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. My name is Jerrica Walker. My first name is spelled J-E-R-R-I-C-A. I am a single parent of three kids. I currently have been working at my current employer for 6 years. I have two children in daycare, a 9-year-old and a 2-year, almost 3-year-old. Right now I get paid twice a month and I live paycheck to paycheck. One check goes to bills and food and the other one is for my rent and food. So there really is no any extra for even emergencies or the occasional doctor visit. And when you have a 2-year-old that thinks he's Spider-Man, Superman, and Iron Man rolled in one, you are occasionally at urgent care unexpectedly. It really can cause a strain on my household when emergencies arise. And that is one reason I appreciate that my daycare is based off of my income. Prior to working at my current job and getting child care assistance, I did depend on a family member of my middle child to watch my child at that time. They felt that I wasn't paying them enough to watch their grandchild and called me one day at work and told me they no longer would watch my child. I was forced to try to find daycare that I could afford on the income at the time I had. There was nothing affordable, and the ones that I could afford just didn't give me a good feeling to leave my child there. I was forced to quit my job at that time. Prior to quitting my job, though, I did go down to Ramsey County and I asked for help. And there was no help for someone who had a job at that time. They told me they could put me on a year waiting list, and in a year they could help me get assistance. My only option was at that point to quit my job, go on assistance, and wait for them to give me my daycare assistance, which is what I did. And I was lucky enough to get a job within 2 months of getting my daycare assistance. And again, I've been there now for 6 years. I feel comfortable leaving my children at this daycare center. I know that they're well cared for, they're fed, they play. My 9-year-old, he gets the help that he needs with his homework. And that relieves a little stress off of me not being able to be with them because I have to work. I need to work to support them. And as a single parent, that one less stress in my life is like a ton off of my shoulders. It's a relief to know that every day my kids are well taken care of and that it's not a terrible burden on me to pay this daycare cost, and that if emergency does happen, then I can take from my other bills and still be able to afford my daycare and not risk being terminated from my daycare or not able to pay my daycare and therefore kicked out of my daycare. Excuse me. So again, I appreciate the fact that I have the daycare assistance because there is very few programs out there for a single working parent. There's programs out there if you don't work, but if you're working, the programs are minimal to none. So again, I appreciate, and I think that in raising the cost for daycare so it doesn't really match your income would put financial strains on parents like me that are out there taking care of their children and trying to be self-sufficient.
Thank you very much. You have two more testifiers I see. Shannon Greeley or Susie Brown. Who would like to go next? Welcome to committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and committees and members of the committee, my name is Shannon Greeley. I am the director of the nationally accredited Brooklyn Park New Horizon Academy. My center also holds a 4-star rating through the Parent Aware program, and I am a member of the Minnesota Child Care Association. I am here today in support of House File 768. This bill goes to the heart of how Minnesota ensures that all Minnesota's young children and their families have access to high quality, affordable early childhood settings. The Child Care Assistance Program was slashed in 2003, and while we've made some very modest increases since then, we still have not returned to where we were before 2003. The current reimbursement rates are significantly below the market rate. For example, in my center, we charge a toddler rate that is $39 higher than the weekly maximum rate reimbursed by Hennepin County. This difference between the market rate and the Child Care Assistance Program must be managed in one of two ways. Either the cost is absorbed by the center, or the cost gets forced along to the parents to have to pay it. In the current economic times, licensed child care centers will have no other option but to pass this cost onto the families as an individual weekly charge beyond the already monthly parent portion. Many, including New Horizon Academy facilities, already do this. I support this bill for three reasons. First, by increasing the reimbursement rates to reflect the true cost of quality child care programs, many families will see a direct decrease out of their out-of-pocket expenses. These families currently have to pay significant weekly costs resulting from the difference between the true market cost and the true market cost and the CCA cost for the education and what the counties are reimbursing the programs for. Second, by increasing the reimbursement rate, more families will have equal access to high-quality child care programs. As the system stands now, there are many families who qualify for child care assistance programs, but they're unable to pay the weekly difference between the market cost and the outdated reimbursement rate. This effectively limits the family's access to the high-quality experiences necessary for each child, experiences that each child equally deserves. Third, this will allow quality providers to continue to provide service to low-income families. As a company, from 2003 to 2008, New Horizons Academy experienced a growth of enrollment of 21.3%. But during the same period, families enrolled in all of our centers using the Child Care Assistance Program, the funding dropped by 9.6%. In my center, personally, I serve a high amount of population of low-income families. And my enrollment for children receiving child care assistance since 2003 has dropped by 35%. I am here today asking you to pass this bill. This bill is good for young children, this bill is good for families, and this bill is good for Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Susie Brown. Welcome to the committee. If you can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. We're a statewide coalition of child care advocates and individuals. We're working to develop public policy initiatives that increase access, affordability, and quality in child care in Minnesota. Thanks for your time today and for the opportunity to testify on this bill. I'm here to share with you some background information on child care in Minnesota. The research is exceedingly clear on the architecture of young children's brains. We know that children are learning all the time in whatever setting they are in. And we know that for at-risk children, these settings are critical, particularly during the early years. In Minnesota, most of our young children are in child care settings, whether it's a child care center, a licensed family child care home, or with a family member, friend, or neighbor. About three-fourths of Minnesota's families with children under age 13 regularly use some type of child care arrangement, and over 360,000 children spend some portion of their day in a licensed care setting. In 2003, the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network issued a report with the National Economic Development and Law Center on the economic impact of the child care industry in Minnesota. In that report, three important points were made about the way child care affects the state's economy. Child care has an immediate impact on the economy by supporting working parents. Child care impacts the long-term economy by providing quality programs that prepare children for school and can reduce costs for a whole range of social issues in the future, a theme which you've heard championed by Art Rolnick of the Federal Reserve Bank, by Ready for K, by the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, and others. And child care is itself a major contributor to the economy, an important small business sector providing work for over 36,000 employees and circulating over $900 million through the economy in 2003, recently, and that at that time was about 77% of the size of the corn industry, just to give you some perspective on that part of our business sector. When we look at child care in relation to the needs of the current workforce, over one-third of Minnesota's workers have children under the age of 18. As you likely know, Minnesota has one of the highest work participation rates for women in the nation, with about 75% of mothers with young children in the workforce. If we look only at the early years prior to kindergarten, we see that over 250,000 children live in households where all parents work, which means that either both parents of a dual-parent family are employed or all of single-parent families. 68% of Minnesota children under the age of 6 live in these households and are in need of some form of care. In 2004, Wilder Research conducted a child care use study in Minnesota, of Minnesota families to get more specific data, and reported the following results. 20% of parents said that child care problems had interfered with their getting or keeping a job in the past year. 37% of households said that they or their spouse or partner had lost time or income in the past 6 months due to a child care problem other than a sick child. And the number of parents who reported that they had to take whatever care they could get increased from 8% in 2001 to 29% in 2004. And that brings me to the issue of access to child care. As of December 2008, we had 11,800 family child care providers and 2,000 center-based programs, including child care centers, preschool, and school-age care programs in Minnesota. In addition, an estimated 150,000 households provide care for families, friends, or neighbors, with grandparents as the most common providers. Unfortunately, we have seen a net loss of nearly 1,500 licensed child care programs in Minnesota between 2003 and 2007. And that is the net loss. We've seen over 3,000 programs close in the last 3 years alone. Every closing has multiple impacts, including a loss of a business, the loss of the training and experience of the provider, and providers on average have been in business for 10 to 15 years, and the loss of stability for the family, and most importantly, the severing of a close relationship that has been built between provider and children. It is in all of our best interest to help good providers stay in business, particularly in these economic times. Another large barrier to access is the cost of care. Most families who use child care have significant out-of-pocket expenses. Households with low incomes shoulder the biggest cost burden relative to their incomes. For upper-income families, child care will usually consume about 7% of the family's income, while for low-income families, child care can cost up to 30% of their gross income. At the same time, families with young children are usually at their lowest earning point in their careers, given that they are likely at an early stage in their professional lives. Expenses can range widely depending on the age of the child, the type of care, and the geographic area in the state. For a family with a preschool-age child and an infant, full-time care averages between $15,000 and $24,000 in the metro area and between $12,000 and $16,000 in greater Minnesota, depending on the care setting, substantially more than the annual cost of tuition at the University of Minnesota. It is not hard to see, then, that the cost of child care is a significant concern for parents of all income levels, but especially for low-income families. As you have heard from our provider testifier, child care programs already operate at the thinnest of margins, and in some areas, they operate at a loss. Due to the freeze on provider reimbursement rates for child care assistance in 2003, and despite the fact that there have been two small increases since then, we are not even close to covering the actual market rates, and many providers are seriously struggling. We built our child care assistance system based on offering child care choices for parents. In fact, the federal government requires that we give families equal access to different types of care. In 2005, we were at the 55th percentile for access to centers, and we were sent a warning letter from the federal government that said we should get back to market rates, and we are not providing equal access. The most current data shows that only 40% of centers and 55% of family child care providers are within reach to child care assistance families, unless they or the program or a third party can pay the difference in the rates. In 2001, by comparison, more than 80% of all providers fell within reach of reimbursement rates. In closing, I'd like to offer a few additional points about just how much the child care assistance picture has changed in Minnesota in recent years. Prior to 2003, Minnesota was ranked 5th in the nation in income eligibility. It is now ranked 42nd of our 50 states. A family of four making over 175% of the federal poverty rate, which is around $35,000, is not eligible to enroll. The cost for care for two children at this income level is a very serious financial burden for families. We are only one of 17 states that either doesn't budget enough for child care or doesn't forecast for it. While over 16,000 families and 28,000 children are served through the MFIP and basic sliding fee programs, nearly 7,000 families are currently on the waiting list for assistance. When a center or family child care program is unable to provide high quality, all of the children are negatively affected. If a program closes, all of the children and families must struggle to find new care arrangements. And if we reduce access to care for child care assistance families, particularly to quality care programs, we do not see the long-term savings to society, and we all lose. We know that child care is early education, and that whether a child is in the preschool room at a child care center or the four-year-old program in a school or in a standalone preschool or Head Start, or of preschool age and spending their day with a family care provider, all of these situations offer critical early learning every day. We know that the state is facing one of the toughest economic circumstances in recent history, and there will be a need to make cuts to important programs that serve children and families. And we recognize that the investments in child care and other early childhood opportunities are a valuable and strategic investment for the state with both short-term and long-term economic benefits. We urge you to support House File 768, a bill which will improve access and affordability of child care for families who are working, and will make progress toward rebuilding the stressed child care business sector. Given that the state is unlikely to have the resources to fully fund these programs, we recommend that you consider directing some portion of the funds in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act to fund the proposals in House File 768. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I believe the Chair just distributed a fiscal note. Members, this is fresh hot off the presses. We had requested this a little while ago, and we were able to finally have it delivered today. So I haven't fully been able to look at it, but I just wanted to point to it. And members, obviously, these are not insignificant numbers. These are big numbers. But I think one of the things that tells us is that it really makes the point of what this state did, you know, rightly or wrongly, but what this state did several years ago when we backed off the dominant agreed upon philosophy in our state could provide for child care assistance in order to meet several important goals for us. And so the numbers are large in part because the need is large, but the numbers are large also because, frankly, we slept quite a bit over the years. And so those are the numbers that we have been able to hold to our agreed-upon commitments from a decade ago, where those would be. But I'm not sure, and perhaps, Madam Chair, I don't know how you want to proceed. You may want to have someone from the department come and explain part of the system. I leave that to you, but what I'm not sure is, you know, how these numbers compare to the base. I'm just quickly reading through this, the current base expenditures. Madam Chair, as the last testifier just shared, there are a number of ways in which we can do this, and I think as a group we can work on this if there's a desire to do that. If we're not comfortable with working towards returning ourselves to the 75th percentile market rate, we can plug in a rate increase like we did a couple of times over the last few years. And then also, obviously, because the BSF, the basic sliding fee, is based on whatever we can appropriate a number to that. It's not my intention that we approach this as an all or nothing, but I think it is important for us to know just exactly how far we have slipped. And and the last point is that to the degree that any possibilities of access and stimulus money could help with this, I would encourage us to look at that.
Thank you. Representative Greiling has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it is important to bring bills like this forward no matter what the deficit and what the times are. We don't keep in mind that we don't just have a deficit, but we're also behind. And that's why we have the new Minnesota Miracle, where we're $2.5 billion behind, counting the property tax relief, in addition to this $7.5 billion counting inflation deficit that we have. And now we get here and we find out that we're way behind here as well. My question is, I'm wondering when were we last caught up on this so that we were at the 75th percentile?
I'm sure the answer I'm going to ask staff. Mr. Murd, would you like to answer that?
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, I think that the rates were frozen in 2003, and that prior to that was the last time that we were at the 75th percentile.
Madam Chair,
Representative Greiling.
I'm remembering I asked this question before because I remember the answer now.
I think that was the last big year we had cuts. And we talked about the difference between a Chevy and a Cadillac model and all these different kinds of child care. And I think really the points we heard today is it's helping families to keep working. We do have a question.
Just very quickly.
Representative Marianne.
Thank you. The my understanding is that the 2003 action froze what was the 2001 rate that had been established in the previous biennium. And so remember, we're talking about a framework here that, quite frankly, is a market-based framework. You know, we said, let's pay not even full market rate, you know, let's pay 75% of what the market is here. And so we're looking at that rate relative to 2001 rates to 2003.
Representative Kulik-Jackson?
I just wanted to confirm what the testifier was saying through my own experience in 2003 when my youngest was 3 years old. I was a full-pay parent in rural Minnesota where we only had one center. And the CCAP kids were part of the critical mass. And I remember the center nearly closing out of concern for cuts. And that would have not only deprived those parents who were working at low-wage jobs, but it would have deprived me of having the one quality care center in a small town in rural Minnesota. So that's yet another angle.
Thank you. And I think that's in the testimony by Ms. Brown. We heard how it affects the whole industry and how big of an industry it is and when it make a lot of business, how many people that affects. Are there any other questions, members? Representative Mariani, have any closing comments?
Bless you. This would be bless us all. Madam Chair, again, these numbers we can plug in, however, if we want to address this issue. We all know the issues well. We know the importance of addressing them. We obviously are facing, you know, dire fiscal times. We do apparently have some flexibility with federal stimulus funds, and I look forward to us, you know, discussing our willingness and ability to use that, perhaps, and then to decide at what levels. Anything we can do beyond what we're currently at. And again, my final thought really is that, you know, we really, in my mind, need to be doing all we can to encourage people to be able to keep jobs. To remove whatever barriers to work could exist, and that's a large part of what we're able to do through the Basic Fighting Fee program in our state. So, Madam Chair, I guess with that, I don't know if we have to renew the chair. Do I just renew the motion that we lay this over for possible inclusion in the finance bill, the omnibus finance bill here?
Well, thank you. Representative Mariani moves his motion that House File 768 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. Thank you. Members, we need to move the minutes. Has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes? Representative Peterson? Okay. Representative Peterson moves approval of the minutes for March 10th. Is there any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and the minutes for March 10th are approved. Well, the next bill up is 597. It's the bonding bill, and I'm going to ask Representative Rosenthal to come over, take over the chair. And I'll proceed to the table.
Welcome, Representative Slado. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 597 be moved for
be laid over.
be laid over. Thank you.
Yeah.
So we can, Mr. Chair, we lay over House File 597.
And is the bill in the proper order that you'd like it?
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment.
Representative Slawick has an author's amendment labeled A1. May I have a motion to put the bill in the form that the author wants?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an A1 amendment. What this does, it takes the amount from $5 million down to $3 million for the amount of bonding. So hopefully this is fairly a technical amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to appreciate my testifiers for traveling here today and being with us. I'm going to talk a little bit about the bill, members, and then let them tell you more about their experiences with the Early Childhood Early Intervention Grant Program. The State Early Childhood Facilities Grant Program is for building or rehabbing facilities for early childhood and early intervention programs. That's how our bonding bill works, members. Last year, the legislature included $2 million in their bonding bill for this proposal, but as many of you might remember, the proposal was line item vetoed by the governor. The need has increased in the past year, and we are requesting $3 million this time. Investments in the infrastructure of early childhood, whether rehabbing a preschool so that the environment is more conducive to learning, or building a shared community center where ECSD classes might meet jointly with Head Start and child care classrooms, is vital for the strength of our community. The program requirements for this particular program, while funding comes from capital bonds, it's actually more like a state grant program. Cities, counties, and school districts apply to DHS for the funding. Private child care providers or Head Start programs must partner with the political subdivisions to receive the funding. So that's similar to a bonding arrangement. It builds on and encourages collaboration and partnerships by giving priority to projects that involve collaborations of the programs, which you're going to hear more about. Priority is given to areas of the state with the highest percentage of children living in poverty, the children who will benefit the most from the high-quality early education settings. And there is a map in here, members, from 1992 to 2008 that shows you where the early childhood facility bonding program sites have been. Other project priorities include projects that will increase the child care workers' wages and projects that utilize youth build for construction of facilities. Grants for the individual facility must not exceed $300,000 for each program that is housed in the facility, up to a maximum of $750,000 for a facility that houses three programs or more. State appropriations must be matched at a 50% basis with non-state funds, and the matching requirement must apply program-wide and not to individual grants. Just a little bit of history, members. From 1992 to 2000, these bonds financed grants for early childhood financing totaling $13 million to 56 sites statewide. In 2002, the bonding bill was vetoed, which included funds for early childhood facilities. In 2005 and 2006, the program received $500,000 each year. Last year, of course, there was $2 million again, but then it was line item vetoed. When resources are in short supply, and we know this in particular right now, and also when we're having such high unemployment, members, we know this program this program is very important. In the last funding cycle, DHS received 50 inquiries about the funding and nearly $2 million in requests for 7 projects. So this is very this money is in high demand. Of these projects, 3 were funded. It's critical that the state take this opportunity to invest in early childhood through facility rehab and construction. These facilities help create jobs, which is a priority, particularly in these difficult times, and meet the growing demand for high-quality early learning experiences. So now we're going to hear from the testifiers. First, I'd like to welcome Nidra Sims-Spears, who's the Business Development Director at First Children's Finance.
Welcome. Maybe could you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Nidra Sims-Spears. Thank you for this opportunity to speak about early care and education facility bonding. First Children's Finance has been engaged with Head Start and the broader early education community on this issue since 1991. First Children's Finance is a nonprofit corporation. We target public and private investments to drive the supply of quality child care throughout Minnesota and in 7 other states. Minnesota is our home base, and we are very thankful for the role that the state of Minnesota and the local foundations have played in helping us to establish financial services to the neediest of communities and to replicate excellent programs like our loan fund, which the state supports, and this child care facility bonding bill. FCF offers a continuum of capital investments, including loans, grants, and loan and grant combinations. To date, we have made $6.4 million in loans to more than 237 early education businesses. This has created or improved more than 7,000 spaces for children. It has also created or has sustained 919 jobs. We have a default rate of less than 3.2%. Our loan funds leverage funds from banks and other investors. This bonding bill is a very important tool for investing in early education and is a companion to the loan fund. Right now, bonding bill is needed more than ever and has an unprecedented opportunity for impact. At FCF, we have been studying how to make effective investments in early care and education for 17 years. We are happy to be able to report that the Minnesota Early Education Facility Bonding Bill has many of the hallmarks of wise and strategic investing. A central feature of the program is that it incentivizes partnerships and collaboration. This is extremely important and will continue to be even more important in the future. One of the things that we've learned over time at FCF is that quality and sustainability are directly tied to an organization's ability to partner and collaborate. With partnerships and collaborations come the ability to withstand economic downturns, leverage resources and strategies, and to innovate. Now more than ever, we need to innovate. We need innovation, sustainability, and quality early education environments that help our children become ready for school and create the workforce of the future. We think that this bonding bill does exactly that. This bonding bill also has many of the components necessary to leverage, dovetail with, and take advantage of other economic incentives. Schools and other community education partners are looking for opportunities that are ready to go. The bonding bill makes that possible. There will be an increase in early education scholarships, and so there will be an increased demand for quality spaces. The bonding bill makes that possible. There will be a premium on innovative initiatives that can utilize energy efficient and green designs. The bonding bill will be able to leverage untraditional resources in that way. There will also be a premium on initiatives that have other components, such as healthcare, which will be another untraditional funding stream. The bonding bill is very compatible with that because it encourages multi-service collaborations and partnerships. The bonding bill should be able to leverage more funding than ever with a greater impact on more families. And my boss, Jerry Cutts, likes to say, more blankies for the buck. This bonding bill has an important resources for communities in Minnesota. Our colleagues nationally have drawn on the Minnesota model, and some states like Connecticut have taken it even further. We think that an opportunity to draw on the success of the bonding bill and even take it to a new level of impact in Minnesota. At First Children's Finance, we are prepared to leverage additional resources to provide technical assistance to innovations that we will use to partner with to promote energy efficiency and green design that will establish innovative partnerships with community businesses and partners and that will demonstrate quality childcare. We also think that there's an important opportunity to leverage federal resources for facility improvements that are not just tied to public facilities like the bonding bill, and we welcome a conversation about that as well. Our CEO, Jerry Cutts, is in Washington, D.C. right now working on trying to leverage additional dollars for child care facilities and would welcome a conversation at his convenience when he returns. I thank you for our opportunity to share our experiences and thoughts and hope to partner with you to bring additional resources and strategies during this important time. I would also like to say that for our centers, we have financed 237 centers, and many of those centers basically use CCAP programs. Our centers target low and moderate income households. Many of those households rely exclusively on CCAP to fund their education, their early child care costs. And our centers are impacted with, they're looking at a reduction in the money that they take in for their families because the CCAP drops, the money that they get drops. Coupled with that, if they don't get CCAP and they have working class families, many of our centers are experiencing severe economic distress because the working class families have lost their jobs. And the first thing you do when you lose your job, you pull your kid out of daycare. And so it is very difficult. Most monies, child care centers, and I look at budgets day in and day out, they go 95% for operating costs. There's not a lot of money for capital improvements, capital replacements. So a bonding bill like this that does new construction or renovation really would help child care centers significantly.
Thank you.
My next two testifiers have traveled away, so we appreciate them taking the time to be here with us and telling you about their experiences.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Richard Bartz, B-A-R-T-Z. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Richard Bartz, and I'm the elementary principal and director of community education for Houston Public Schools in Houston, Minnesota. I'm the DOT in the far southeast corner of the state. I was one in the last round of the funding for the bonding bill, and we received $96,000 in matching funds. And I'm here because we received the money to renovate the main floor of our early childhood center. Our early childhood special education program, our community preschool program, and our early childhood family education program collaborated with SEMCAC, a Citizens Action Council, and their Head Start to renovate the main floor of the Early Childhood Center in Houston. Houston's Early Childhood Center was originally located in the basement of a former church that had been donated to the school district several years ago. The main floor was being used for district storage. Renovating the main floor of the building doubled the size of classroom space, creating a total of 4,600 square feet that will be used to house the integrated program for childhood education. This added area is going to be used to expand preschool hours, to increase the ability for preschool and Head Start to serve a greater number of students, and to provide a community placement, making it possible for early childhood special education students to attend both morning and afternoon sessions of our language-rich preschool. It will also establish a place for in-home child care providers to meet for education and support with and without children in their care. It will create an early childhood family education parent meeting place and a lending library. And finally, it will add an adjacent playground area especially designed for young children and children with special needs. A little history of our project. In April of 2005, the Houston School District acquired the former Presbyterian Church building. The church needed renovation, and the congregation had become too small to take on the task. The school district began using the basement and the main level of this building as storage. In the spring of 2006, the Houston School Board voted to establish and fund all-day, everyday kindergarten. This meant that the preschool and early childhood special education room would need to be moved to another location to create a second kindergarten classroom. In the same year, Houston School District entered into an agreement with SEMCAC, Head Start, to provide services to qualifying children. The children joined the inclusive preschool early childhood special education classroom. And so now we had early childhood special education, regular ed preschool, and Head Start all meeting in one location. The Houston School District paid to renovate the basement and create an early childhood center. In September of 2006, the Early Childhood Center became the new location for this integrated program of preschool, Head Start, and early childhood special education, all meeting in the same room. This integrated program continued to expand and to outgrow the location. Funds were needed to renovate the main floor of the building to accommodate the growth. Without the additional funding, the district would have continued to use the space for storage. In March of 2008, we successfully wrote the grant requesting the matching funds necessary to renovate the facility. The renovation is almost complete. This project has created jobs for our community. Local plumbers, electricians, carpenters, masons, carpet installers, floor refinishers, heating, venting, and air conditioning gentlemen and women have worked on this project. It has also meant employment for students from the Alternative Learning Center located in our community. It means future jobs. The students from Summit Learning Center will be employed again this spring when we do the landscaping and construct the playground. Additional staff will be hired to educate the young children in this renovated space. In conclusion, Houston has had a long tradition of maintaining our facilities, even after the repairs of the flood of 2007 and again in June of 2008 where the groundwater devastated much of our facilities, our ground level facilities. The building in which I began my teaching career 25 years ago and I'm currently the principal was built in 1939. And it was part of the WPA project. It's in excellent shape. Energy-efficient windows, ADA ramps, wireless internet throughout the building, and a heating and air conditioning system that I can control with my BlackBerry. Yet, I can tell you right here that the main level of that early childhood center would not have been renovated without this grant. Thank you for letting me testify, and I invite you to the open house for the facility on April 18th. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Sounds like a great project, and I was relieved that you didn't travel from Houston, Texas, which I originally thought. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Stephen Nagel, and I'm the director of West Central Minnesota Community Action. We're headquartered in Elbow Lake. And I've been involved with three projects. We don't currently have application in, but I was involved in a project in Monaga and Parker's Prairie and Browns Valley. In all three of these communities, there weren't locations to have a Head Start Center that could be licensed either in the private or the public sector. So the bonding grant made it possible to have Head Start Centers. And today I wanted to talk specifically about the impact that this bonding program had on Browns Valley. And the Browns Valley Center was completed in 1999 and became functional in 2000. And it was an $80,000 investment, which $100,000 was raised locally. Now, more importantly, in Browns Valley, since we didn't have space that we could get licensed for a Head Start Center, it was a home-based program, and the home-based program is a very, very good thing for helping parents and children. But what our parents were really seeking was to have their children in a center that would and that would make it easier for them to work. And virtually all the parents in the Head Start program are working. When we built the center, that allowed us to have. In addition to the Head Start Center, we partnered with the ECFE program, and the building is also used by the Public Health and Social Service Department, Habitat for Humanity, Alcoholics Anonymous, Rural Minnesota SEP, and Legal Services. It was the first new structure in downtown Browns Valley in 75 years. Really made a big difference, and it wouldn't have happened. But when we look at the impact that it had, instead of serving 12 families with one home visitor who visited the home each week, there are 20 families that come to the center. So over the last 9 years, there's 72 additional families that we were able to have in the Head Start program. The other thing that it happened where we had one teacher that served as the home visitor, now we have five people that work seasonally, the teacher and two aides, a cook and a bus driver, and seasonally those folks earn about $80,000 a year
which is just kind of equal to the state investment in 99. Over the last 9 years, they've earned $920,000, roughly. And significant employment opportunity in a town like Browns Valley. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and you heard earlier about the work being that's going to be available for people in the building trades. One of the other things that West Central Minnesota Community Action does is the weatherization program, which we're in the process of gearing up. But we advertised for an auditor, and this is from Elbow Lake, Minnesota, and we had over 100 applications. The last time, 5 years ago when we hired an auditor, we had 8 applications. So it's an indication of how much, how difficult it is for people in the building trades right now. And I urge you to consider this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Slawik?
Mr. Chair, I think we'll stand for questions. You heard excellent testimony from all three testifiers and the reasons this is a great program.
Questions from members? Representative Diskin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slawik, just for my information, one of your charts here has a graph and talks about early childhood facility bonding programs sites from 1992 to 2008, yet as I look at the statute book, the program itself, the history says it began in 1998. Do you know how the funds were dispersed prior to 1998?
You know, Representative Diskin, Mr. Chair, that's the year I came to the legislature was 97-98, so that was my first term. I would have to ask staff if they...
Anybody from DHS here that might be able to answer? Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, Francie Mathis from Department of Human Services. And in fact, it was 1992, the first year that the bonding program started. And if you look at the last page of this handout, you'll see the projects that were funded in that year. $2 million was appropriated that year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question is, what was the statutory authority, seeing as this statute only dates back to 1998? Whatever people brought to the table, possibly, and then this was developed to give some kind of criteria and structure?
Mr. Chair, it was originally a bonding bill in 1998. It was geo bond money. It was a new idea in 1992. In 1998, it was the biggest appropriation of $5 million, and part of that was general fund money, and part of it was geo bond money. So the statutory authority in the first year in 1992 was just a geo bond project. It has evolved over the years. So,
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that does bring me to my second question, because that is that's good to know, because I noticed that in the statutory language that's referenced in the bill for how the grants are dispersed, one of the conditions where the commissioner may give priority to is grants for programs that will increase child care workers' wages as a result of the program, and so really has nothing to do with facilities. Now, I would understand if it was a general fund appropriation that would be appropriate, but Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if bonding dollars can be used to actually increase workers' wages.
Ms. Mathis?
Mr. Chair, that language was added in, I believe, in 1998 and has just remained in the statute all along. So the way we've managed that is during the RFP process, we ask responders to speak to that issue. In fact, no one has really made a great case for that over the years.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Slawick. It wouldn't be your intention that this appropriation simply go to increase wages. It sounds to me like your intention is to develop programs and the facilities necessary to serve more children. Is that correct?
Representative Slawick.
Chair, Representative Diskins, yes, that's correct.
One more question.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slawick, can you, or maybe one of your testifiers, another one of the priorities, and this is a must and not a may, but the Commissioner must give priority to, is a program called Youth Build. And I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what that is, but if you know, that would give me a shortcut.
Mr. Chair, Representative Diskins, this is, as you know, things at the legislature here evolve over time depending who the members are and what their interests are. This particular provision was put in there by one of our members who was interested in having a program called Youth Build Get Good Projects. So I know we've changed it to where it should be, I think it says it's a priority or it's built in conjunction. It's a must. We worked on a few times trying to change that to a may because Youth Build is not everywhere in the state. And so we found that actually to be a somewhat limiting provision. But this is one of the senior members, and it has not been easy to change that provision. But I will ask the testifiers to comment on that as well.
Well, two of the projects I worked with had Youth Build programs nearby, and that is in Monaga and Parker's Prairie, and that worked really very well. The project in Browns Valley didn't have anything nearby, and it was real hard to hire a certified instructor because in the building trades, because they tend to build houses in the summer, you know, and we couldn't. And really the only way that it happened is that the sheetrocking of the building was something that I did myself with some other people and the kids. It was very, very difficult. The advantage of the Youth Build in that year is that so many places couldn't do it that the competition for the money was, you know, wasn't as great as it would have been. I'm not sure that's a reason to have Youth Build in it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Slawick, I do appreciate the fact that you're trying to make this change because, especially in a down economic time, it probably will fence out a lot of potentially deserving programs throughout the state that don't have a Youth Build nearby, and there is going to be tremendous competition for whatever dollars are out there. So I appreciate that.
Representative
Bowers? Mr. Chair, Representative Diskins, you could think about carrying that amendment maybe sometime if you'd like to.
I'm your huckleberry.
We can talk more about that. members, I think this is one of the best programs in early childhood and in bonding that we can do and to get needed funds out to areas that can do so much good. So appreciate your consideration and your support.
Any other questions from members? I renew the motion that House File 597, as amended, be laid over.
Thank you. Now we are doing the shuffle back with the chairs. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. I think you get better each time. Lots of practice. Well, thank you. And next we have House File 641, which is Representative Peterson, Office of Early Learning created. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do you want me to move this?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd
like to move the bill.
I would move House File 641 be laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill.
Thank you. If you'd like to tell us about the bill.
I would. And I'd also like to at least introduce the two folks that I have with me today. Zoe Nicolai, who is, I know, with has done much work with the build, and I don't know, you're not ready for Kay.
We're ready for Kay.
And then we have Rob Gruenwald from the Federal Reserve Bank, who has worked with Art Rolnick and has had a long history of support and working for early childhood. And the bill that I have before us today is one of the two things that the about 130 member Early Childhood Caucus could agree on, and one was the QRS vision for standards in early childhood, and the second one is that we look at some sort of office for early childhood, and this is a bill that would create an office of early learning that would coordinate Minnesota's early childhood system, especially the programs in the departments of health, human services, and education. And currently there are many programs scattered throughout the state government that touch children's lives, be it ECFE or Head Start in the Department of Education, Child Care and Human Services, or Family Visiting in Health. But we're seeking not to create a new department. We don't want a new department. We're asking, and I hate to even use this term, but it's a czar type of person, and who would coordinate the programs efficiently, more efficiently, and actually save dollars on time and duplication of services. And we have a model for that with the higher ed. Susan Hegard does that sort of coordination with all the higher ed groups. And my sense is that higher ed is very important, but so is early childhood, and it would be a good model for us to look at. Again, I think the Senate has a little different version of what this office would look like, but it would. We think it's a very good model to at least begin to address. And the director of this office would be appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and responsible for coordinating department staff efforts to coordinate funding streams, enabling the departments and the array of early childhood programs to work together more efficiently, create common standards for quality and rules for training, leading to better accountability across programs, being a clearinghouse for up-to-date, accessible information on early childhood and care for all stakeholders, enhance the ability of early ed programs to deliver high-quality services by streamlining administrative requirements, providing education opportunities, and supporting efficient and effective business practices in state government. Build on the strengths of the current system and minimize weaknesses and maximize resources. Provide timely and comprehensive information to the governor and the legislature for cohesive decision-making. All these efforts would greatly serve the end user, parents, and their children. An example of an added benefit of an Office of Early Learning is to look at the programs within DHS and MDE. Child care is often not seen as early learning, and the more that education can work with child care, the more ready many of our young children will be for kindergarten. And the more that the child care community can assist the education community in understanding child development and the importance of play and experiential learning, the more our school readiness and preschool programs will effectively teach young children. Another example of where coordination is needed in Minnesota is to look at the pre-K allowances and the development of a quality rating system for early childhood programs, where MDE and DHS have struggled sometimes to come to an agreement on a common set of standards. And I will say that they are working together, I think, very hard to do that job, and it would be good sometimes to have somebody else who could work with them. An Office of Early Learning would have been the perfect place for these discussions to take place. Finally, the Office of Early Learning would focus on creating opportunities for Minnesota's youngest children to develop and learn to their fullest potential. By developing an effective early childhood education system with high standards for programs and professionals, supports to meet these standards, accountability and community engagement, an office would create a seamless system for early childhood. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Rob Gruenwald to talk about a little bit more about how effective this kind of an office would be.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rob Gruenwald, Associate Economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And my comments here are my own, not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve or others at the Federal Reserve. This committee has heard from Art Rolnick, Director of Research at the Minneapolis Fed, earlier this year about the economic benefits of investing in early childhood. As you've heard from him, such investments benefit taxpayers to reduce need for welfare assistance, increase income tax revenue, less burden on the criminal justice system, and fewer children needing remedial education services. Evidence from four long-term studies show that rates of return can reach as high as 17 or 18% annually for high-quality programs that reach at-risk children and their parents. As Art and I have traveled to other states, we've noted that a number of states with substantial investments in early learning also have a means to coordinate early childhood functions across departments, either through a coordination board, a director, or a separate office or department for early learning. Creating an office of early learning in Minnesota would be consistent with these efforts to improve coordination and help carry out the state's early childhood investments more efficiently. Some states have built new structures with authority and accountability for early learning initiatives and bring together child care, pre-kindergarten, and regulatory functions. For example, Massachusetts and Washington have created new departments, although that's not what this bill is doing here. Georgia and Maryland have moved early education programs and functions from other agencies into an existing state agency. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania has left early education functions in their respective agencies and created a high-level management team to create unified policy and implementation. And this approach most closely resembles the model that's proposed before you. States that have moved toward system-level coordination noted that the number and amount of early childhood services available in education and health have grown, and they're located in many different areas within state government. And potential benefits from systematic coordination through an office or department focused on early childhood include improved access to families on information about and application for early childhood services. Families would receive a seamless set of resources from prenatal through age 5, reduced duplication of administrative services, a boosted efficiency such as coordinated professional development across agencies, a consistent child assessment and outcome system, and improved information sharing across early childhood functions. Since these coordinated governance efforts are relatively new, there hasn't been a systematic review to determine whether they are consistently achieving these benefits. However, evidence to date indicates that coordinated governance of early childhood is achieving at least some of the benefits that I mentioned before. According to a case study of the Massachusetts model, the combined department is building a strong integrated infrastructure, promoting consistency in regulations and policies, revamping its technology systems, and expanding access to child care for families. Meanwhile, the director for the Pennsylvania Office of Child Development and Early Learning cited the creation of common quality standards for early childhood programs, along with vigorous monitoring and oversight. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Before our next testifier, we have to make a note that she's retiring. For Ready for K. So we have one, you have to do the special initiation to early childhood and tell us where you lived when you were 3 and your favorite childhood game. Could you tell us that, Ms. Nikolai?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm Zoe Nikolai, and yes, I am retiring from Ready for K. What was your question?
Oh, well, you have to tell us where you lived when you were 3 years old and your favorite childhood game. All of our committee members had to do that.
I lived in Charlotte, Michigan. And my favorite game was probably playing with my twin sister and teasing our younger brother.
Thank you. And members, what I'd like to do is what they do in early childhood classes is sometimes they give people standing ovations. So if we could do that, members. For Ms. Nick Lye, to say thank you for all of her service. Thank you. You deserve that. You deserve that and more.
Madam Chair, thank you. I hope I can make it through my testimony after that. As I said, I'm Zoe Nikolai, and I am still currently, until the end of April, the Early Childhood System Specialist at Ready for K, and I manage the BUILD initiative. We're one of 7 states now that receive funds from the National Early Childhood Funders Collaborative through the BUILD initiative to look at how can states develop effective coordinated early childhood systems. So I'm here to speak in support of House File 641. This committee, you exist because you know what happens in those years 0 to 5 has just a critical impact on children's healthy development and their success in school and later in life. 0 to 3, National Organization says, young children's needs and abilities are complex, and therefore a comprehensive approach to ensuring their optimum development must cross several domains, health, mental health, education, and social services. And you received, you were handed out a little one-page diagram of how we're really trying to move the discussion and broaden the concept of an early childhood system as one that supports families and sees children thriving as being this system of subsystems, 4 subsystems, early learning, family support, special needs early intervention, and health, mental health, and nutrition. And I think all of you know children and families, and many of you have children, and you know that they don't just develop in one area. If we want kids to be successful in school, it's not just access to early childhood, quality early childhood experiences, but it's their health, the good nutrition, mental health, and their families access the kind of array of supports that will help them function. But when you look at this map of these 4 ovals that intersect, and mine looks different than yours, first of all, because it's in color, and I'm sorry our color printer broke down. But I started mapping out where in the departments do the kind of services that these 4 subsystems, where do they lie? And when I finished, I was even more so thrilled that we are at the point where Minnesota is really looking at a governance system, both an early childhood advisory committee and this Office of Early Learning. Because I'm going to just very quickly mention the array of programs, and it's not even, I can't even say, okay, early learning is in the Office of Education, because you've got DHS that has does child care licensing, the child care quality initiatives, the parent aware, child care research and referrals, all the professional development council training activities, the early learning guidelines were developed there in concert with some of the other developments. And then in MDE, you have Head Start, school readiness, the early learning standards for kids 3 to 5, the assessment, a kindergarten entrance, Even Start, parents know website, etc. And then you have when you look at the oval, health, mental health, and nutrition, all over the map. Okay, Department of Health, we have newborn screening, environmental health, immunization, well child visits, WIC, follow along program, home visiting, prenatal care. Go to DHS, same oval. You've got Medicaid, MinCare, the child and teen checkup, children's mental health initiative, and special needs. MDE, we've got they take care of early childhood special ed, Part C, and at the same time, you've got in the Department of Health, children with special needs. So family support, we've got MDE, ECFE, Great Parent Education Program, necessary for parents to help them in learn about good child development. And then you've got this whole array of supports at DHS, child care subsidy, child welfare, the strengthening families approach to preventing child abuse and neglect, etc., MFIP, food stamps. And so we have this array of programs in these 3 key departments that make up these 4 subsystems. And yet we don't have anybody who has an overarching view of how does it all come together. You're not even here at the legislature. We've got different legislative bodies committees that are responsible for the funding streams that fund these programs. So I really like this notion of an office of early learning as, first of all, to me, the state is really saying this is a priority. Early childhood is a priority. Tremendous importance that we support our families and young children 0 to 5. And someone does then have that big picture. It can lead to more integrated services. You heard from Rob some of the other advantages, more joint planning across sectors, more service coordination. And I know I've worked in state government for 13 years, and I've been out of the field for a long time, and I know there are many good examples of coordination that's happening. There's also a lot of, I hate to say, you know, maybe I was not as smart as some of my other colleagues when I worked in the department, but when I worked at DHS and then it was CFL, I didn't even know the array of programs in the health department that impacted young children. And, you know, I'm not so sure that if we give a little test to all of our state employees, everybody would be able to say, here are the other programs that we know about that impact children. And families, when they're trying to come in the doors of these programs, they've got this huge array of programs, and sometimes communities do even a better job of coordinating, and many times they don't, and it's families that are falling in the cracks, especially our most vulnerable families. So I think that's all I need to say, and I appreciate this committee taking this approach to really thinking about this as a way to help build an effective early childhood system.
Thank you. Is there any questions, members?
Comments.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's interesting because you're right. You talk about having the staff take a test and figure out all the programs. And I was wondering if we could get a list of all those that are available.
Ms. Nicolai?
Madam Chair and members, a reference that I will make available, a guide, that while the research is completed, it's an asset review, and I think it does a pretty good job of going through all of the programs that exist. But
That's online.
I also can just see if copies can be delivered to each of the members.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be real quick then. Representative Peterson, thank you for bringing this forward. And as the testifier said, this just clarifies and identifies the need and purpose of early childhood in our state, for sure. When this happens, the one question I had is, who would this office report its activities to?
Representative,
I didn't see that. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, the bill actually talks about the governor certainly having that information and then reporting to the legislature also.
Representative Ward, that's a very good question. I think Representative Peterson's worked very hard on how to work that out. Representative Greiling?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, it looks like, looking at the fiscal note, there are no costs, but then I look on page 3 under the assumptions, and it looks like there are costs. And I'm wondering, which is it?
Madam Chair,
Senator Peterson.
We have actually, and you could go either way. I mean, you could take it out of existing staff, which is an interesting concept. We did ask for a fiscal note on this, and it's the fiscal note that was given, I think, was a little high. What we really need is a director and an assistant, a support staff. And if it was in the governor's office, I was suggesting that perhaps the cost be spread over the Department of Commerce because it affects certainly the workforce, and maybe DEED because it affects the workforce again, and maybe the Department of Health, the Department of Education, and take, you know, a certain amount out of each of those departments for the person. I read in the paper that that's sometimes how it's done in order to fund these particular positions. But in light of that, if it's not done that way, the cost would be about $200,000, maybe $250,000 at the most. I think we can find furniture and other kinds of things that were listed in the ultimate fiscal note here. But we thought we could do it cheaper. Now, so you could use existing staff, or you could go to the cost of about $250,000.
Representative Biskin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, was a fiscal note ordered on House File 641? Because I see the fiscal note that is in our packet was actually written to a bill in the last biennium. Was there a fiscal note asked for on House File 641?
Yes. Representative Peterson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, there was. And the total amount, including equipment, office furniture, office space rental, and all of those things, came to $471,000. However, I don't think we need all of those things. I think what we need is one FTE director, one FTE support, and that would come to $200,000. Now, that if you go $250,000, you allow for maybe a desk and a chair. But this is meant to be a facilitating position, not a whole department.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Peterson. I've often quarreled with fiscal notes I've received on my bills also. However, I usually lose, and the chair of the committee says, well, yeah, maybe, but this is what they put in front of us. This is what we have to live with, and I do understand that. I looked through the fiscal notes, I was as surprised as Representative Greiling. I'm thinking that I had to cozy up to this Representative Peterson. She must know somebody I don't, all right, as I'm looking at zero and zero. However, when I read the assumptions, right, it looks like both the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services punted simply because they point to the bill itself and say there's no appropriation line in the bill itself. And so I'm wondering if that is an oversight. And then going to the bill also with potential oversights, I'm wondering on page 2, line 24, how we would receive a report by February 1st of 2009.
I'm Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, I do think that's a typographical error. Sorry. It should be 2010.
I think Representative Peterson, does that answer all your questions, Representative Peterson?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, members. We're just about out of time. I just want to thank Representative Peterson for bringing this bill forward. It's something she's worked very hard on for. This is now her second session on this. And what we find as we go around the country, it's, you know, cost isn't as much the issue as is who's the decision maker going to be and who can work an MDE with MDE and DHS and say this is the way it's going to be. And they told us it was a person that could kind of crack heads and say, this is it. We're going to work together. And ultimately, the costs are saved because you have less people going to the same conferences and doing some of the same work. I'm not sure if the department would agree with all of that assessment, but that's kind of some of the things. I know she's talked about this nationally as well and looked at models around the country. So, Representative Peterson, do you have any closing comments?
No, I think our departments, both of our departments, Health, Human Services, and Education, do a great job, but I would like to see this kind of an office, and I think it's the model throughout the country, and usually Minnesota's leading the way. We aren't doing that in this one. We're kind of a little bit behind, and I would like to see us get this in place, because I do think some of the other pieces that we have in our early childhood program are nation-leading. And the MILK program, the Parent Aware, some of the things that we are evaluating, I think are really important pieces and need to have that kind of director in this kind of an office. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 641 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. Thank you. With that, members, we are adjourned.